it's an insecurity that I carry with me and that I know is silly, and I don't, I like myself, and I, you know, and I think I'm lovable. I think I'm attractive. You know, I think that people like me and people are attracted to me, but there will always be the fat kid in me that, that's being called the fat kid. And there's always going to be me thinking any rejection is probably because of that. And I mean, personal, professional, whatever. You know, it's just, it's a place to hang your shit. It's a place to hang your insecurities, because otherwise, what is it?
Hello and welcome to Bald Talk, the podcast that dares to have two or less bald comedians chat with bald celebrities, average Joes and Josephines, mythical beings, normal creatures, and really anyone bald about being bald, and sometimes we chat with someone who isn't bald. I am Brian Husky, a bald dude, and once again I'm flying solo as Charlie is away until the Witness Protection Program deems it safe for him to return. But today we're opening our podcast conceit up to include a harrow. But what a harrow he is. That's him in the background, eagerly waiting for my introduction of him. This man has been a television presence for close to 30 years. Okay, wow, he's old. He was a sidekick to Conan O'Brien on Late Night and The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien, and he continued that talk show relationship with Conan on his show, Conan. He was the star of an excellent sitcom, Andy Richter Controls the Universe, which featured my neighbor, Jonathan Slavin. He has done so much other TV and film work, including Elf and his voice work as Mort in the Madagascar series of animated films. And he's currently, well, he has his own podcast, The Three Questions. If you haven't figured it out by me literally saying his name, you're not paying attention, please welcome to Bald Talk, Andy Richter. Andrew, hi.
Hi, Brian.
Lovely to see you.
It's good to see you. The last time I saw your face, if I may say this, was during one of Matt Besser's Friday 420s.
Yes.
Deep in COVID, he used to have a 420 with just a bunch of guys.
Bunch of aging comedians.
Yeah, and we would get together on Friday at 420 p.m. because we had nothing else to do. And just, it was actually really, especially then, in the depths of the pandemic, before, you know, pre-vaccine, it was like water. I would hang out with you guys, I was always like, oh my God. You
know? It's so crazy. And I was like, and I was in that space where I was like, I'd been alone so much. I'd see my girlfriend and my daughter and my ex-wife. That was like my human, that was humanity to me.
Yep.
And I was getting to that point where It felt wrong. Like I felt wrong and weird to see other people.
Yeah.
To kind of like make, I mean, I was doing this podcast and I had that as like a thing of like, okay, well, I have to do this for my job.
Yep.
But like a socialization thing.
Yep.
I would always be like, I don't know if I can. And I was like, I completely can. I am doing nothing. I absolutely can.
The first time I went to like a party, I think was Conan O'Brien's Christmas party, which he throws every year. And it's, you know, it's, he lives in, what do you call it? The Palisades in like that. And, you know, like it's
He's got a small, humble shack.
It's a small high school that he lives in. But no, it's, I mean, it's also, it's like very star studded. And with COVID, it was less than it normally, people it normally is, which just means it kept out the riffraff. And it was just pure famous people.
The people who could really get the medical attention in an instant.
Yes, exactly.
That they needed.
Exactly. Yeah. But I just, on the drive there, I got really nervous about having to make small talk with people, many of whom I've known for 30 years.
Yeah.
But it still was like, oh my God. Like,
oh, completely.
How am I going to not hide out on the periphery? You know, am I going to actually engage?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, no, it's I still I still am going to have some sort of like rehabilitation skill, like just learning to do it.
To be again. Human again, yeah.
Yeah, because I went to like, I mean, we locked down real hard because my girlfriend has asthma.
Oh.
She was really anxious about it. My daughter sort of has asthma, but not as seriously. And it was just that space where you're just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, nobody knew.
You know, and it's just a floodgate of negativity of information and stuff.
Yep.
And you have to kind of piecemeal and stuff. But yeah, I went to one party that was just a gathering that our improv group did to sort of like stay in touch. And it was after, it was once the vaccines were there and we could take off our mask. And I would go in and out of wearing my mask outside with other people.
Yeah.
I'd be like, I'm fine. And I'm like, oh, I'm scared.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it was it's kooky. Yeah. How, what do you like, I'm so curious what other people's like flexibility and doing stuff is. Because I'm still not eating in a restaurant. I'm still wearing masks in everywhere I go. I was trying to have some people come over to eat dinner tonight, and I don't know if it's going to happen. And then I started to have that thing of like, well, maybe it's best because it would be kind of nerve-wracking
to
get used to it. Yeah.
Well, I'm still, I try to avoid eating indoors at restaurants unless it's like, most of my restaurant eating is, you know, diners. Around, I live in Burbank, and it's like, you know, it's like sort of a brunch, you know, because I don't eat before, you know, like I drive my daughter to school or have the workout or something. So I usually have kind of a brunch regardless. And they're at diners. And if it's like kind of empty, it's like, all right, that's okay. But mostly I try and sit outside, and I still go to the grocery. I go to the grocery store, you know.
Yeah. I do that.
And I'm very sort of, you know, I'm good about wearing a mask. I still fucking get up to the door of Ralph's without it on. 2 years later, and I'm like, oh fuck, my mask. Got to go back to the car, you know.
And then how many people are clocking you and being like, that?
Look at it that usually is triggered by somebody shooting me in like a look, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And I'm completely. God bless them. They should, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I haven't been like super restricted, and I even actually was kind of dating through the last couple of months.
Oh wow!
Because I had broken up with somebody, and then was actually got on one of the apps because I was just like, I gotta meet somebody, and you know,
yeah, that's how I met my lady.
Oh, good. Yeah, I heard, you know, Nick Kroll and his wife met. It was either on Hinge or Bumble. I can't remember which
Raya,
one.
Actually.
And I was loath to do it. And then as I got into it, I'm like, well, this makes total sense.
Yeah.
Oh, was it Raya that they met on?
It was Raya. Oh. Yeah. Did you try that?
I was on Raya.
Oh,
right. I did that. Right after my wife and I separated. I mean, like within a couple of months.
Raya to me felt like that Conan O'Brien Christmas party that I was going to.
I was on there. Nikki Glaser is a friend, and she was on the show, and I was talking to her about it, and she said, oh my God, I could set you up on Raya. Like, I could recommend you for Raya, because if you want to date
before the council.
Yeah. and she's like, you know, if you want to, because that's, you know, it's kind of exclusive, and then, it, you know, people won't be bothering you, and so try, and she recommended me, and it came through, and I got to sign up, and I was on there for literally a half an hour, because I just was like, ugh, it made me like have vertigo, just the notion of like all these, just like, you know, just.
There are so many photographs of people in like idyllic Venice, Abbot Kinney-esque restaurants or sort of like vacation situation. Everybody was just like, oh my God.
If you went by these photos, and this isn't just Raya, this is any of these dating apps. If you went by these photos, anytime you go to the beach, there would be 50 to 100 women romping in the surf to getting their picture taken. Like hands in the air with a big floppy hat, like, here I am, because everybody's like
living life.
Yes. How would it, like, and I always be like, you know, it's just like somebody will have pictures of like at the beach, hiking, you know,
yeah,
near some parasailers, you know, mm-hmm, in totally. Paris. And to me, it's like, where's the pictures of you, you know, watching Judge Judy? Because isn't that what most everyone's life really, truly is? Where's the pictures yeah. of you picking up dog shit in your yard, you know?
Where are you hunched over your computer with your shoulders up yeah. near your ears, making a shitty face?
Right. You standing in front of the microwave waiting for the lean cuisine to be done. But Raya, yeah, no, Raya was, I've said this before, like, the breaking point for me, just on Raya, and also, like, it was also new, and I was still so, just, like, such a raw nerve, but oh, the man. Breaking point was this woman who listed her occupation as denim architect.
Interest, okay.
And I was just like, oh, no, no, no. You mean you alter blue jeans?
You mean you make structures out of... You make shanties or from you're, pants?
Or you're making low-income housing out of, yeah. out of old Jay Leno shirts, you know?
Or you make really stiff jeans. Like, you make impossibly
yes,
stiff
yes.
dark blue denim jeans.
So, yeah, so I got on the Hinge, and then it was really not, you know, it's been nice. But I've been dating, and you know, part of that dating process is I'll take a... antigen test before yeah. I come out, that kind of thing. And you kind of have to yeah, trust totally. People, but you also, you know, like, I don't know. I mean, it seems the sort of like common sense, practical, pragmatic idea of, you know, like, well, get the vaccine. Like, I just feel like you can kind of tell. Like, you can, yes. like, somebody, you can oh, meet yeah, somebody yeah. and you're like, I bet you're boosted. Oh, yes, of course. I, you know,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a weird thing. I had my deck fell apart during, or my steps basically fell apart during pandemic.
Oh, sorry like, about right. that. Yeah.
I posted a few things. I thought there would be more outreach from the community, but nobody cared. So this dude, like, found him, talked to him, British.
Yeah.
You know, right away, you know, that they're going to be
classy,
smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Classy. He told me this story about his daughter getting COVID, and it was a long COVID situation. And it got really dire. And so he apologized, like, I'm sorry I haven't gotten back to you, which for a contractor to say that, I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But he was like, I've been dealing with this. I'm so sorry. You take all the time you need, you know, just check back.
But where's my fucking stairs?
But hey, man, I'm walking around looking like a jerk stepping on these rickety, dangerous steps. I'm sorry your daughter's almost dead.
Right.
So she was fine. And then I was like, and he came over to sort of talk about the stuff they had done, and I was like, I'm really happy, John, really wonderful. Oh, we can take our masks off, you're vaccinated. He's like, oh no, actually I'm not. I'm like, what? But your daughter. He's like, I know, I'm just an old man and I'm scared that I'm gonna get it. And I was like, hold on a second, you're scared of getting it from the vaccine after your daughter almost died from it? It just was like I just was like, okay, people are insane.
Yeah, I know.
Fear is just turns your brain into a milkshake.
I don't understand it. Yeah. I don't understand it. But I mean, it's such a, I just recently had an exchange with a relative, asking what the status of the people in their family was. And I said, like, are you boosted? And they answered, well, actually the booster is detrimental. And this person is vaccinated.
Oh, wow.
The booster's detrimental. And I just said, no, it isn't, but I don't want to talk about it. Like, because it's like, you have to work to find information on the internet that says the booster is detrimental. Like, yeah. if you Google COVID booster shot, the first five pages have got to be saves lives, does wonderful things, seems to really work, and then just...
Yeah, that's called the fine print, my friend, and welcome to yeah, the right, real contract right. that America's drawing with your body
sure.
and your health.
Sure.
Anyhow. All right.
So about baldness.
Oh, great segue, and thank you for that, Andy.
No problem.
That is why you are a TV yeah. presence for 30 years.
I'm not sure why I'm on here, but then later I'm on a podcast called The Skinny Report. And again, I don't feel it's that one. Oh, well, that one I'm not so happy about going on.
We're gonna rationalize our conceit around you very, very soon.
Oh, good.
But I did. But I did find an entry point for you.
Oh, good.
And, I don't want you to feel like this is some kind of gotcha journalism, some kind of, like, I don't know, called out PC wise. But I'm gonna quote a couple of tweets you put out.
Oh, shit.
About being bald.
Oh, okay? Fuck.
This is in the human and like the record of time. Yeah. That is Twitter.
Yeah.
First one, October 23rd, 2013.
Mm.
Think of how fun balding would be if instead of losing hair, you kept the same amount of hair and your head just got bigger and bigger.
Come on. That would now, be pretty great.
As a bald person,
yeah,
our heads are already getting bigger and bigger as the hair goes away.
But not really.
But visually.
Yes.
We are an optical illusion.
Right.
And we have to deal with that every day.
Right.
And then hairy, cocky, hairy dudes like you are getting on Twitter and just bald shaming us.
I don't think that's bald shaming. I think that that is shows like, well, first of all, a childlike naivete about how the body works, which I definitely have.
Sure.
The second thing.
By the way, I'm doing a kind of a character right now.
Oh, I know.
I don't really believe that.
Okay. Should I just stop explaining myself?
No.
I have a lot of jokes about, because I love like those big carnival Mardi Gras heads that people wear.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a kink of mine. And so.
Okay, cool.
I was just thinking, right. I was thinking about that and I was, you know, so I thought, well, that would be a fun way to get bald.
I did feel like I had like an erotic subtext. Oh, this
everything
post.
I do does.
It totally does.
Everything. I'm hard as a rock right now.
But yeah, I think that's going back to the tweet, that would be amazing.
Especially some people, that would be awesome. It would just see you.
That would be.
And there, you know, and I mean, I swear my head is getting bigger as they. I do think some people's heads get bigger as they get older.
Your noses and ears do.
Yes. Yes.
I know that.
Yeah.
And that was a bummer to me because I have long ears. My daughter quickly. She went through that age period where they just would come up and be like, ew, you're bald. Ew, your ear is weird.
Yeah.
Ew, your nose is too long.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, all right.
Yeah, thanks, baby.
Yeah.
Let me list your frailties.
Don't worry. I can probably mess you up in a way you won't understand.
Yeah.
It'll come back to
you're
haunt
short.
You. You're
you
short.
You used to shit your pants all the
you
time.
You will probably not amount to much. All right, go play.
Enjoy your burning planet, stupid.
And then more recently,
uh-oh.
Yeah, this is June 26, 2021.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And this might have been one of your erotic blackouts. I don't know what.
Okay.
What prompted you to put this up? The only way I'd wear a hairpiece is if I went bald. Okay, let me start over.
Okay.
The only way I'd wear a hairpiece if I went bald is if we have the technology, then we allow me to, when startled, press a button that would make the toupee do a 360 pancake flip and then land neatly back on my head. I think that's worth. Yes.
Yeah.
I would agree.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
Completely.
That would be fantastic. I think. And yeah. Was there a typo in there? Did I say that instead of than or thans? I think it sounded like it.
I don't. Yeah.
It doesn't matter. You get the idea.
Grammatically, it wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, people don't read it grammatically. They autocorrect in their head.
Yep. I would love to live in a Benny Hill episode all the time. Just like, you know.
Yeah.
And talk about anti-bald, the way he used to slap that little old man.
Totally.
Remember that?
Well, that's what.
Smack, 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 smack.
It's so funny how much, I mean, it's that thing of, in comedy, a lot of things that were like, used to be kind of tropes of just like, yeah, I'm going to make fun of the fat guy.
Yeah.
The short guy, the bald guy. You know, whatever, kind of being taken away. But bald is evergreen.
Yes.
Like, you're just always going to get some bald zingers. You're always going to.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, and fat is still an issue. You know, like the.
It's not, you know, it's
not as much as it used to be, but it is, you know.
Generationally, my daughter has corrected me from when I've said someone is fat.
Yes.
Like, don't say that.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Like, it makes me uncomfortable for me to hear you describe someone that way. I'm like, okay, that's cool.
Over Thanksgiving, my mom told my niece, who is 16, you're too thin. And she said, Grandma, we don't talk about people's bodies anymore. And I was like, yeah, good for you. Exactly. Just keep it off the table.
Completely.
I mean, unless you're with like someone that you know is a real asshole. and a bitch like you are. Like, that's kind of, yeah. Like, I have people in my life, like, I know I can say the really mean shit right now because they're awful people too, you know?
Yeah, I don't want to say there's wholesale awful people. I'm just going to isolate something about them that's in their control.
Yeah.
They're and like, then if they improve that, maybe like, that'll lead to...
My friends that I can off-gas around, you know, just get that poison out.
Is that what you call farting?
No. It's just ridding myself of hate and aggression and, you know.
I imagine as you purge your anger, you also fart at the same time. It's like, oh, God, please don't get angry. Please. It's terrible for everybody.
Yep. Whenever I say something... socially unacceptable, I just rip one.
You get out of my station!
Yeah. Well, you would say that, you Latvian. Oh, jeez. I shouldn't have brought the ethnicity into it.
Yeah. Oh, man. What was it? So you don't have any... You have a full head of it. You're chalked.
It's chalk going full. Back. It recedes and it has been situational too, because when my wife and I split up, it was like hair was jumping off my head. Like I didn't see the hair, but I could see it like start thinning in the front.
And it was that, do you think that was from stress?
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of stuff? Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And I take Propecia. I do take Propecia.
Oh,
yeah. And I might even have started that when that started. Because, and it just, you know, just, I mean, and that, I guess, just holds on to what you got. Like, I'm not growing hair in other weird places, but I'm like, you know, one little pill, you know, it's like, okay, that's worth it, you know?
Yeah.
But what hair I do have is like healthy and kind of thick and, you know, it's my kids. We're a good hair family. My kids have real thick hair, and I will probably do what my dad did, which is just recede back into one of those, you know, like probably start to bald on the top a little, and then kind of the top spot in the front will sort of try to meet. Before I go into the
solar
ground.
Panel. Yeah. Kind of. Loop around. Yeah.
So,
yeah, it's so weird. Like, I was talking to somebody this week, and I just like one of the things in getting into the entertainment business was this thing of like, oh man, I really don't want my body to be my shop.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to, like,
or be the deciding factor in why I get hired.
Completely.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I personally go in and out of like, I don't care. I really don't care. It has not hurt me whatsoever, as far as I know. And then when times are a little lean, which are right now, it's sort of not doing much. I'm like, I bet it's this. I bet it's this.
I do that with weight. I think if I dropped 20 or 30 pounds, I'd work like crazy. And I've made the joke, and it's not really a joke. If I lost, you know, 30 pounds, I could then get jobs as the fat guy. Like, you know, because there's the fat guy that everyone's comfortable playing the fat guy because, like, he's not, you know, he's fat, but he's like TV fat.
Right.
I have still COVID weight. I lost weight. I lost about 40 pounds, started with stress just after I moved out in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And
Man, that's a confluence of life events.
Yes. Oh, and then I lost 40 pounds because I just couldn't, I wasn't eating for like the first month or 5 weeks or something. And then, you know, I had kind of had a momentum and I was like, okay, and I was really good and really, it was exercising a lot and stuff. And then COVID hit and everybody's talking about baking bread and I can't go anywhere and I can't go to the gym and I can't, you know, and I'm like, well, everyone else is eating bread. You know, it's like, I thought, well, the rules of like nutrition have changed. Like there, you know, it's obviously you can now carb up and
comfort food is it's a medical need right now.
Right, exactly.
Like, it really is like a thing.
And so I put all that weight back on and I got it like 5 of it back off, but it kind of goes back and forth. But yeah, it's like, it's just one of those, it's an insecurity that I carry with me. and that I know is silly, and I don't, I like myself, and I, you know, and I think I'm lovable, I think I'm attractive, you know, I think that people like me and people are attracted to me, but it, there will always be the fat kid in me that, that's being called the fat kid. And there's always going to be me thinking any rejection is probably because of that. And I mean, personal, professional, whatever, you know, it's just, it's a place to hang your shit. It's a place to hang your insecurities, because otherwise, what is it? Is it, then it's just you, you know, it's just, it would just be like me. And I don't know, I can handle that too. It's like,
And it becomes a thing where it's a place to hang your insecurities because everyone else is in agreement with it. Like, you know, it's you're a punchline or you're a joke or you're, you know, whatever. I can't remember the actor's name. Oh, he was the guy in the heavy kid in the Goonies.
Yeah. Chunk.
Chunk.
Yeah.
He stated a lot of things like how impacting it was for him to just, because he, his, the story he told was like, he was excited to be an actor. He got some roles. He thought he was getting roles because he was good. And then he started to have that realization. It's like he was getting them mainly because he was heavy.
Yeah.
And then he was good on top of that.
Yeah.
And I think anytime you let other people sort of define yourself in any way, your worth, your sense of yourself, it's hard. It's hard to kind of wrestle it back.
I actually just yesterday read an article. It was an interview with the kid that played in the Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Does your daughter have you seen those movies with your kids?
Yeah.
The hit, his name's like Grumbly.
I think that's the person I was thinking of.
Okay.
Not Chunk, but yes.
He's fine, but he got an eating disorder when he became a teenager. Mm-hmm. And he had no idea when he got hired, and everyone's, you know, praising him and saying you're so great. Like when he got that, he didn't know. He's like from somewhere else, not from Hollywood. And then he started to figure out, like, oh, I'm just the fat kid.
Yeah.
And there was some, he was up for to be the lead in some movie that was like some fat camp movie or something like that.
Yes. Yeah.
And they flew him to Los Angeles. I think he's from the East Coast. Flew him to Los Angeles, and the audition was just take off your shirt, eat something, and then like smile and laugh or something. And that was like, oh, you got the part. And it fell through in development, and he said he was glad that it was. But it is like, I have thought this for years, just like, and it's also like in dumb comedies, like 80s comedies, you know, there's like the cast of characters, and there's the nerd, and there's the jock, and then there's the fat girl, you know?
Yeah.
And I always, my heart just breaks for these women. And it's just like, ugh, you know? But I mean, I've had moments where I've had to be like, okay, yeah, I'm, you know, I'm overweight, but what the fuck? You know, like, you know, I'm right-handed too. Why am I not getting all the right-handed parts, you know?
Yeah.
That kid, one thing that he noted, and I almost like put it on social media. I mean, because it was an interesting article, and it does make you think about, well, first of all, casting is stupid. I mean, like, if casting were an entity, it would be almost brain dead, because casting is just obvious choices, like, you know, like pretty girl, you know, not pretty girl, handsome guy,
ruggedly handsome guy,
his like chiseled unattractive pal that is sort of just functions to bump, you know, hold up his fancy or his handsome friend. And because it's so stupid, it also can get mean. Like, it can be a very mean part of the industry, whether it means to or not. And this kid, and when the Wimpy Kid movie first came out, he said everybody called him fat in some different sort of artful way. And I had the exact same thing when the Conan show aired. Every time somebody mentioned me, and I mean, we got terrible reviews out of the gate. A few good ones.
Yeah.
But, you know, in 1993, I could not read more synonyms for fat. So many different ways to call me fat in such a necessary way. And his sidekick, the portly, the cherubic.
His robust, jolly reactions.
You know, skinny had fatso just to provide some comic contrast, you know.
Yeah, it's so strange. I mean, so then it kind of goes back to that thing of like, there's almost the expectation. It reminds me, it's like my daughter correcting me. There's been a number of different things where I've had my kind of like, wait, now hold on a second. What, you're overreacting. You know, I've had my kind of like 50-year-old man.
Right. Privileged like, white guy.
White guy. Here's the defense as to why I'm saying I understand, but here's why. And it's come up more and more with so many things in comedy because she's getting into comedy stuff.
Yeah. How old is she?
And she's 14.
Okay.
And so, you know, and it's the kind of thing of like, I found myself trying to defend Andrew Dice Clay's stand up.
Mm-hmm.
And then the more I was talking about it, I was like, no, you know what? He's playing a disgusting character. And that's just giving, and a lot of this stuff has kind of been supported by like, yeah, you got somebody like Trump who fans the flames of this kind of thing. And his defense is like, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
And then you realize like, oh, it is still like I say, it's toxic.
Yes.
Yeah. It has power.
Yeah.
And the power exists in the volume of people who are like, don't worry about it. And then the minority who are being, you know, shamed or just used.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
like reduced to like a punchline or whatever.
There, I once had a conversation with Sarah Silverman because, you know, she used to kind of be like the, you know, like if Snow White had a filthy mouth, that was kind of like, you know, she's like this pretty kind of
went there.
Yeah. Like innocent looking and her delivery was kind of, you know, had like a kind of like childlike wonder to it. And then mm-hmm. she'd say the most heinous, awful stuff, including derogatory terms for different races and whatever. And mm-hmm. I talked to her and she stopped doing it because I think she realized, yeah, some people understand the irony involved here. And some people understand that this is funny because it's so awful and there are people like this. But mm-hmm. the people like this are taking it for face value and going like, she's saying this and ha ha ha. You know, good look, she's mm-hmm. saying it. Why can't I? And I think, you know, it's, I heard somewhere like Chris Rock's old bit about the difference between black people and N-words.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was appropriated by racist people. Like that just gave,
you
know, and I don't think he does that. You know, I mean, why would he do those old bits? But like, I saw him talking about how that bit, like, you know, he doesn't exactly take it back, but but it had an unintended consequence of people thinking, oh, what, you know, what's the big deal?
Yeah. And it's sort of kind of like you said, it's the jokes are dumb.
Yes.
They're easy.
Yes.
You know, and I feel like increasingly like satire is getting harder to do because the things that we're satirizing, you know, like on Veep and stuff, it got harder and harder to sort of poke fun at administration because the things that were actually happening were more insane than what they could cook up.
Yeah. They would be rejected if you brought them in as plot points.
Yeah. And then it's like, this doesn't even match what's going on right now.
Yeah.
And, but then the other thing is like the people don't get it. You know, it's like people just don't get why, you know, if we were to do a thing where we like had a fat character and a bald character and we're using them to satirically point out that it's cruel
you know,
to make fun of them. So people would probably miss it.
Yeah.
They would just be like, that's pretty funny.
Yeah. I mean, I look at old clips from the 90s of the Conan show and we made jokes like we would make sort of, you know, like gay jokes that I wouldn't make today, you know? And I mean, and they were mild in comparison and and like one thing that struck me when I started working on a television show and we had to come up with comedy every day was how many jokes are kind of from a male perspective. And like a classic version of it is you've got the setup of, we've got something that will be guaranteed to get attention. cut to sexy girl in a bikini dancing.
Right.
And I, you know, and I would always make the point, women don't, they're sexy girl in a bikini dancing, you know, cis hetero women don't, they don't want, you know, that's not like a guaranteed eyeball pleaser, nor is it to, you know, gay men, you know, or it's like that you're, and it just, it's like you said what you said to your daughter, which I have a 16-year-old daughter, and she set me straight on shit. Like, especially you know, the they, them kind of stuff. We got into an argument about it. And I was just crabby and annoyed that I was being corrected by what was probably then a 14-year-old. Mm-hmm. And I thought about it and I thought, no, you're absolutely fucking right. If that, you know, I don't, if you're in comedy and people say, hey, that hurts my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got to really measure the value of, like, what's more important? These people, these human beings' feelings, or, you know, you made a funny joke. You know, you think this joke is so great and so funny. You know?
So I used to do these commercials for Sonic Drive-In.
Yep.
And they let me go because I was doing some videos for The Onion, and one of which got sort of cited by a veterans group.
Oh.
I don't even know if it was a veterans group. Oddly enough, Rob Hubel pointed it out to me. He's like, hey, man, I was looking around on these chat boards. I'm like, oh, hold on. Why are you looking at veterans? Like, the chat boards, like, I don't know. He's like,
that's how he honors the troops.
That's how he, just reads up on it. Unread it. But he alerted me. He's like, these people were kind of talking about your commercials, and they're like, hey, this guy, these people are making fun of me, making fun of us. The bit was that they were criticizing what the government, how the government was treating them, because they were extending the tours of duty in Iraq more and more as it was endless. So their bit was U.S. Military opens up tours of duty to people who are already amputeed or in a wheelchair. They make it like handicap accessible, saying like, we're just going to keep using you until there's nothing left.
Right.
And so the whole bit was like, they're going to retrofit all the tanks. They're going to make it sort of like wheelchair accessible.
So the people whose bodies have already been destroyed by war will keep be getting, sent back to the front to be destroyed even further.
Right. And so that was an example of like satire, them reaction, you know, having a reaction like they're making fun of us. And, you know, it damaged my life in a big way, because that whole thing was kind of eruptive that it went away at the time for me. But now I'm like, yeah, I guess so. I think at the time, if somebody, my thing was like, if somebody from The Onion had just communicated with them, but they kind of were like, no, we're just kidding. You know, that kind of, for them to have that response, like it's just a joke, doesn't communicate to the person what their intent was.
Right.
And so the two sides just didn't, it was still defensive and offensive.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
So it never got beyond that. And I think that's like with your daughter and my daughter bringing these things up, I'm trying to get better at not being defensive in my response, but as much as I can immediately being like, okay, tell me why, like help me understand. I don't understand, because I have decades of conditioning that is, you know, predicated on decades of previous conditioning for other people. Mm-hmm. And so we got to kind of, but they want it immediately.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I've told her. I was like, this kind of shift takes a little bit of time. Yeah. You got to give people space to mess up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's true with like just lots of, well, first of all, everybody's aware of everybody else in a much broader way than they were before, because of social media and because of, you know, social media and the internet and everything. Like, the notion of calling somebody they, them, if there wasn't an internet, would be a very niche thing among like a very select group of people.
Yeah.
Which is not great. And the fact is that like, there's some downfalls to everybody having a mouth, you know, like a what do you call it?
A megaphone.
Yeah, everyone having a megaphone, and And there are some ugly thoughts that should perhaps not be spread in the public view. And
well, my immediate reaction is free speech. Free speech, motherfucker.
Free speech, yeah.
No matter what.
Right.
Okay?
Which means I should
shut
be
up
free.
And let me yell at you.
Let me say whatever I want, but you can't say things.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much hypocrisy involved in everything, but, you know, it's the internet does make us aware of, like, you know, that there are people who don't fit into he or her, and mm-hmm. that, like, if you just acknowledging, you know, like, it took me having this argument with my daughter to realize that when somebody says he, him, or she, her, or in their, like, say their Twitter or Instagram bio, mm-hmm. Bio.
Right.
That is just them acknowledging, you're not like saying like people might think I'm, like if I said he, him, and mine, people thinking that I'm a woman, you know, I'm not, that's not the mm-hmm. point. The point is that I acknowledge that there are people out there who don't know what to be called and don't, right. aren't comfortable with the current terms. And this is just letting them know, I hear you, I see mm-hmm. you. And okay, you know, like if we're gonna change it, let's change it. But I'm aware of the issue. It's not, you know, and it's just I can see how trans people or gender fluid people find just the appearance of that supportive, because it means they're hearing me. They're hearing mm-hmm. me that, you know, it bothers me to be called he, him, you know.
Yeah. And my niece was my nephew until two or three years ago, like going through that.
Yeah.
And I still stumble, you know.
I have a niece in the same thing, and it takes a while. And the whole family's trying, you know, to mm-hmm. adjust, you know.
Yeah.
All aboard talk.
Ever heard of social media? We have, and no big deal, we are on it. Check us out on Instagram at Bald Talk Pod or on Twitter at Bald Talk Podcast.
Please make sure to like, rate, and review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
We don't care where you get them, just get them.
No judgment, wherever you get them, anywhere. Anywhere.
Anywhere, whatever. No judgment.
As long as you listen, we don't give a fuck.
Only on Bald Talk.
So explain my daughter, she, on her Instagram thing, she says she, they.
Yeah.
So the they part.
I don't know. I don't know why that differentiation.
Yeah.
Does she tell you why?
Well, the closest, I mean, she said that unless you know someone's pronouns, you should always refer to them as they.
Right.
So my assumption is that she is sort of putting that out there to people is like, you can refer to me as they if you want to.
Right.
But I don't know.
Yeah. I mean,
and I will not look it up and I will continue.
No, well, it's another way she's acknowledging, but she's saying she's agreeing with everyone who says, don't assume. Like her saying they is just saying, yes, exactly. It's true. When you're talking about people you don't know, don't assume. Yeah. And my daughter will tell me stories about things that happened with her and a friend, and she'll say, and then they went to, you know, they went up to onto the roof to watch the fireworks, and I'd be like, they? It was just the two of you. Yeah, and I will probably do that for the rest of my life.
Yes.
And she will say they for the rest of her life. Yeah. And she'll be talking to me when I'm 75, and I'll be like, wait, I thought it was just you and that other mm-hmm. person. Like, no, yes, that's, you know.
Right.
It takes adjustment. And then also, when I got on Twitter and started making jokes, and, you know, and you make jokes, a lot of jokes, one of the things that's fun about jokes is you know, getting up right next to something kind of, you know, naughty. Something that's like, you know, you shouldn't say this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was real defensive when people would sort of like differ, like say, you know, about a joke or something. And I would be real defensive about it. And then I just kind of started, and I would see other comedians be real defensive mm-hmm. about it. And that's what started to make me think, don't be, because I'd see how it looked when they were defensive.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, don't do that because it doesn't look good. And what the hell? So it's just a fucking tweet. It's just a joke. It's not, you know, It's not your epic poem about your life. It's just a right. fucking tweet.
Completely. Yeah. I had a kind of realization, and I want to ask if it's cool, but because we're both divorced.
Yeah.
Like on the other side of my divorce, I recognized and had sort of like pointed out to me, is like, you're a really angry dude. Mm. I'm like, no, I'm not. I don't scream. It's like, no, you just have, there's a lot of anger that you are expressing silently, you know, passive aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to be like, oh yeah, I think I used a lot of comedy stuff to be like, it's, you know, it's that art form where you could sort of, I mean, same thing, like you do it with a song, you could do it with a painting or whatever, yeah. a movie, but you're channeling something into it. Maybe you know it or not, but I always had this thing of like, I was very defensive if people would kind of push back on me saying something inappropriate or being, you know, like a joke. So I was like, oh my God, part of what was funny was like how much it made people wince and stuff.
Yeah.
But now I sort of have this thing of like, that was all about me. That yeah. was all about me manipulating the other person for this reaction, which is a weird thing of comedy in any way, because you are seeking a response to an idea that you think is an unusual take on something.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So you want that response. But it's sort of like with the Sarah Silverman thing. She was probably trying to subvert that she was this attractive, you know, cute voiced girl,
yeah.
And then the woman, and then the delivery becomes this like, oh my God.
She's a fucking genius, and she yeah. understands that contrast is really
powerful.
Striking and really
yeah.
and I mean, I would say 90% of 90% of female comedians are in some way copying Sarah Silverman.
Well, that, I feel like they kind of, I hope it is continuing to shift, because like you said with the writer's room thing, it leads with a male perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, the joke structure, or I don't know, it's not even joke structure, it's just sort of like
the ethos.
American comedy has been sort of like the funny dude is gonna yeah. say something and you're gonna be entertained by it.
Yeah.
And it seems like for female performers, they've had to, I mean, I was thinking about like Judy Tenuta the other day, you know, wearing an accordion. And
yeah.
just this crazy. I mean, that was that period in the 80s where everybody was like a character.
Yeah. Weirdo kind of. Yeah.
But, you know, she had that. And then there was, oh man, who's the lady who had, she's kind of like, had like kind of a mousy, complainy, not complainy, but like she had a very kind of,
Oh, I know who you mean.
You know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. She does stuff for Wait, Don't Tell Me Now. She was doing a persona that was kind of like a definition from a male perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I'm the dowdy housewife, or I'm the sort of weak
right,
woman
right.
speaking up. Phyllis Diller was the, I'm trying to be attractive, but I'm not hitting it
yeah.
fresh.
Yeah.
You know, all these kind of like different, just to kind of, because you have to kind of swim upstream.
Right, right. Well, yeah, like Phyllis Diller, it's like, all right, I'm a hausfrau. Fine. Mm-hmm. Here you go. Here's your hausfrau. Mm-hmm. In your face, making fun of you, making fun of me. I mean, women kind of had to play. Well, I mean, they still, you know, it's still so male. If we had any female comic on here, they'd be like, it's still fucking awful. And it's still
completely.
You know, like I did a live show at Largo that got towards the end of the Conan run and mm-hmm. it got interrupted, but it was basically a showcase show, and I would have three people on it.
Yeah.
And I told Flanagan and anybody that was doing the booking, I was like, there has to be as many shows with two women and one man as there are two men and one woman. I said, mm-hmm. it has to be at least 50-50, because
right.
I don't want to perpetuate that tokenism of mm-hmm. of, you know, well, we do have a woman, you know, like, here's
yeah.
one. And I will say about women in comedy that the internet, that Twitter is
yeah
it women didn't have to go through funny women didn't have to go through some sort of process. They could just
yeah.
put out jokes and people
yeah.
would go like, holy shit, that's funny. And there are so many women on Twitter. I mean, I probably follow more women who are like joke writers. I probably follow more female joke writers on Twitter than I do male joke writers. And it's mainly because I lived most of my life hearing male jokes. And now female jokes are, I like things that are new and interesting and not the same old shit. Yeah. And there's nothing to me more tedious than being in a comedy club and seeing some guy come up and just do some version of the same bro shit, you know?
Yeah.
It's so tired and boring. And, I just, I'm an ally. That's what I'm saying. I'm an ally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, is it cool to declare yourself now?
Sure, sure. No? Yeah, yeah. I mean, okay. I got the I'm an ally tattoo.
I saw that. You keep pulling. You keep suddenly pulling up your shoulder, your sleeve on your shoulder. I'm like, all right. Do you want me to read it? I don't care. Yeah. I mean, it's. I've always that. Honestly, that was one thing that kept me from doing comedy was the bro energy of it.
Yeah.
I think improv spoke to me because I didn't feel like I had to. It wasn't a pissing contest as much, you know.
Yep.
And like when I would do scenes with women, I did better. I was a better performer.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I wasn't as reactionary and I wasn't as sort of like, it didn't tap into my 12-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Which is, and 12-year-old boys are just idiots.
Yeah,
they're just
yeah.
unfettered idiots.
Yeah.
I think that whole experience was like, because I thought about doing stand-up, and then I interviewed a bunch of stand-ups because I was writing a paper in college for it, and they were all just like miserable men whose relationships were garbage. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh, man, this is a toxic, bad world. I don't want to go into it.
Well, I did. I mean, I was from Chicago, so improv was right there. And I knew, like, I liked stand-up comedy, but I wasn't super into comics. Like, I didn't like listen to Richard Pryor albums over and over and over.
Yeah, I've always felt like I don't, but for a long time I was like, I feel like I should be obsessed with these things.
Yeah.
Not.
Yeah.
Like, but then I found the stuff that I was like, well, that's comedy. That's
right,
comedy.
Exactly. Like, for me, it was all sketch things. It was mostly sketch things. And the idea of doing stand-up was when I started doing improv and met people like Matt Besser or Brian McCann who were doing both. And and they were separate groups too in Chicago. There'd be like, I'd go to parties that were like, oh, this is stand-ups. This is a different party.
Oh, completely.
You could feel it. You know, you could feel the difference. And the stand-up parties were much quieter. I used to have parties at my apartment that would be a mix of my improv friends and my film school friends, and like my film school friends would be like, why do they have to be so loud?
Yeah, why is no one sincere ever?
I was like,
I just asked for where the bathroom was and it turned into something about a cruise ship
with an accent and stuff. And
I don't know why.
Like, well, they're excited, you know, I mean, it's like, yeah, I get it. One of the things about stand-up that I couldn't, the thing was, is like, wait, the whole idea is to think up like some set amount of time, whether it's 15 minutes or 30 minutes of stuff, and then you just do that over and over again?
Yes, completely.
Yes. Yuck. And where do you have to do it? In a stand-up comedy club. Those places are depressing, you know? Like,
I know.
Ugh.
I know. Every aspect of it, I was like, I'll be a toll booth operator.
It
feels like it's kind of in the same vein.
And I don't mean to diminish other people. It's like people like hockey. I'm like, I don't know, it's lost on me. And, you know.
But it's interesting, like the more I've known, the more stand-ups I've known who they just talk about it, and it kind of goes back to that thing of like your relationship with the audience, what you're putting out and seeking a response, that I think stand-ups get more into I'm going to see how I can land this joke that I always land. You know, this is my three-pointer.
Right, right.
Here I go.
Right.
You know,
right.
Oh, I hit the rim. Why did I hit the rim? That kind of thing. And I just don't have that kind of like revisiting interest and need as much as like I liked, like, I don't know, let's see. Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh my God. You know.
Well, there are people – I mean, there are – it's they're definitely one aspect of stand-up, too, that just I'm not crazy about is it's very transactional. It's like people come to be fed something, mm-hmm. and then they make a noise. You know, they make this particular noise, and they like making this noise, and that noise makes the person that's feeding them feel good.
What if stand-ups, like, there are different reactions, and so, like, for improv, people laughed. For stand-ups, they coughed. So it's just an audience of people like...
Yeah. Or flap their arms. Just all lines flapping.
Or, like, when you go into a rage, fart. They're just all off-gassing.
And there's some improv people, of course, that are transactional, too, and that live and die by an audience's reaction. But that's not really the point for most of us. I think most of us like being on stage together, and that's where it begins. It's not where it ends, but that's where it begins. It's like, I want to be funny with these kind of people, and here's a group of them, and they're great, and let's get up there and make people laugh, you know?
How are you with, I'm going through a deep, like, grief state around improv, and you haven't done, like, a regular gig for a long time, right?
I haven't.
Did you... where are you? Like, if you had a chance, like, if you were sort of like, hey, would you like to do a weekly thing? Would you be into it, or is it kind of in the rear view?
I might, but I can tell you, like, I still have I have to break through this too. I have an old man's attitude about entertainment. Like, mm-hmm. I'm still from in my mind, like, wait, you do something on YouTube? Like, that's how sad and low rent and stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's fucking millionaires on YouTube. So it's like, hey, grandpa, get with the program.
Yeah.
Not everything ends up, not every sort of like rainbow has a sitcom at the end of it. You know, it's like, there's a million different ways to be funny and to make a living in this industry. So I have very old. So the notion too of like I had to be really kind of be, I don't want to say convinced, but like I had to be made to come around on just having a podcast. Because I was like, what? What are you, like, I don't know, you know, what am I going to do that for?
Yeah.
And I think I liked doing improv, but once I started acting for a living, that's what I set out to do, kind of even like, before that in my mind, it was to be a comic actor. Uh-huh. And I did improv because it was a nice combination of my urge to perform and my urge to write and my terrible writing.
your lack of discipline.
Yeah, my lack of discipline. So I was like, well, here I have to do it all at once without thinking about it. This is perfect.
And no one records it. And so I'm not held accountable.
Exactly. I can just go and hang out and be funny. And if I don't feel funny, other people will be funny. And, you know, like it's like, it's a team, you know. Somebody will score the points tonight if I'm off and whatever. Mm-hmm. But it kind of also just evolved into where when I would do improv, being on the Conan show, and then UCB came shortly on the UCB guys came from Chicago to New York shortly after. And I think the first ASCAT in New York, I was the monologist. And I used to do monologues for them all the time. And I very rarely was just a player. I was almost always doing the monologues, which I could do and I grew used to. It was nerve-wracking at first. And then on the Conan show, I basically was being spontaneously funny every day. Yeah. So I kind of was getting a fix of that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just like, as time went on and, you know, I just became more of a grown up and, you know, I just was like, and I still say this, like, why am I going to leave the house to go get nervous somewhere? I
can wait until the pandemic comes around.
Yeah. I mean, I could think about not getting a job again and that could make me nervous and I could get that. So, and I also too was never that precious about improv. Like I used to get into arguments with people who would be like, why can't improv be on TV? And I would be like, because it wouldn't work. The remote. Yeah. There's no patience in TV. Whereas an audience comes to an improv show, and some people don't even know. They come back afterwards and they're like, wait, you guys were just making that up? That's why it's called improv. But
it's like the energy of it too.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, it's like
Yeah. Well, I always would say, like, look, if we wrote it, it would have been better. Like, it would have been, the jokes would have been tighter. You know, there wouldn't be all those, you know, stretches where people are trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
The people
on
stage, I mean.
Yeah.
So everybody there in that audience is understands. And I said this once on a panel years ago that Amy Poehler was on. I think it was part of the Toyota Comedy Festival at the time.
Right.
And it was an improv panel. And I said, well, you know, improv, I said, it kind of apologizes for itself. There's sort of an implicit apology at the front, which is, don't be too hard on us. Like, keep in mind, we're just making this up. So if there's some, you know, if there's some stretches that aren't better than others, just keep in mind what we're doing up here. And Amy was really, she's like, no, it does not. And I was like, okay, I don't, you know. But I was like, it is kind of, and she didn't like that. I was like, improv won't work on TV. She's like, it could. And
I mean, he's trying.
Yeah, even the improv that has worked on TV, like Whose Line Is It Anyway? It's like, that's not all improv.
No, and that's based on little structured little components
little
that the
nuggets.
Audience is going to understand.
Yeah.
Like, okay, if they hit these marks, then they've done it.
Yeah,
I there's a new improv show on Netflix where it's like the Will Arnett's thing.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that yet. My daughter wants to watch it with me, so I've been waiting.
The clips I saw, I was like, well, I'm not going to watch it. I like everybody involved, but the reason I don't want to watch it is because they include them breaking.
Yes.
They include, they point to the premise. They point to the sort of artifice of it. And so it still has, to me, it still has that thing of like, oh shit, well, you're still doing kind of like a Whose Line little acknowledgement of like you said, kind of apologizing for it and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, UCB tried numerous, they had that thing on Bravo where they basically did ASCAT and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing, like I said, is like the other thing is it's the difference between seeing, I don't know, like a live band and then a concert video of it and stuff. It's just like there is a palpable energy that is generated by physical beings.
Yes.
In the same big room together.
Yeah.
That you can't quite. But and I don't know. I feel like with VR, you might be able to recreate that.
Possibly. Like, I mean,
that,
you know,
it squeezes your head in such a way it feels like the pressure in the room changes.
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of like some things aren't meant to be other things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like some novels make great movies, but some don't. And they're not, maybe shouldn't be a movie, you know? And maybe improv should just be improv. And maybe improv should be a great training ground for comedians that go on to do other, more commercially, just easier. they're just commercially easier kind of things, like a TV show.
You're welcome to have your socialist perspective on this, but I think that there's money to be made from improv.
Yeah. It's also funny, too, just the evolution in our lifetimes of improv, where improv was kind of cool and niche and like quite a striking thing to do. And oh, wow, you guys just make it up. And now it's like, now it's annoying. Now that there's so many improv classes and shit, you know, people are like, oh, you know, like they're just, it's like a fucking, you know, sour note joke. You know, just like an old trope of like improv class, denote like something that's futile, useless, and overdone. You know,
I know. It's like the equivalent of a divorcee taking like pottery class or something. It's like,
exactly.
You're just kind of filling in the void there with that.
Getting your real estate license, you know, like just a euphemism for, you know, disillusion or, you know, like delusional loser.
Yeah. But the crazy thing is like I wouldn't be doing any – I wouldn't be talking to you if I hadn't started doing some dumb improv classes. That's how I learned all this stuff that I had always wanted to do and had unconsciously been doing. So I'm always very – not defensive of it, but I'm just – I guess I'm more defensive of – I'm like, don't judge anybody's entry point into anything. Yeah. You know, because it's – and I kind of love like how weird it can be for people.
Oh yeah,
like yours. Like you have a very, it's a strange way to get to where you are.
Right.
You know?
No, people used to ask me, like, you know, career advice. And I would say, well, take some improv classes in Chicago and then become a talk show sidekick. You know, it's like, what the frick am I going to tell you? You know, I became a talk show sidekick. Like, I mean, I don't even, you know, besides like Ian Carmel, I don't think there's even, they even exist, you know, anymore. So it's,
that's true.
You know, it's like, I don't know. Yeah. It's a, I was like, what was meant to be, well, just functionally on the Conan show early on, it's more interest. I just think it's more interesting to see two people interact on a regular basis than it is to just see one person interacting with a camera or like a David Letterman, Paul Schaefer kind of relationship, which is not, you know, like Conan's and my relationship wasn't exactly equal, but it was pretty close. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, and I was very comfortable most of the time about if I had something good to say, I would say it. Or if there was something I differed with, I would differ with it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of started out just like it was good sense in this early show to just kind of and also spread the attention, I think, a little bit because we knew we were going to go in under fire.
Right.
And it kind of started out as, I think, like kind of a postmodern twist on that relationship. And I wasn't going to just be, you know, a spokesman who is the, you know, like this drunk over here.
Right. Completely. Yeah.
And then it just became, you know, it started out being, like I say, like kind of maybe a statement. And then it just became like, oh, no, this is like one way that these shows work really well.
Yeah.
You know, but also, too, that's not a lot of those shows are just they end up identifying with a personality rather than the entire show. So it's like I don't.
What do you mean?
I mean, identifying like, with like Dave's show was Dave's show. You know, like, you know, like you watch Colbert for Colbert, you know, like you don't want, like, I don't even think that it became much more, I think, a cult of person. I don't know. You can make the case that that was the same with Johnny Carson, but, you know, I mean, Johnny Carson hosted The Tonight Show and there's new people hosting The Tonight Show. So it was more than just Johnny Carson. It was a franchise that's refillable, but it became more and more about Jimmy versus Jimmy and Conan versus Jay and like all the, you know, the bullshit machine needed to make up sort of, you know, pro wrestling matches. And, and I, you know, but there's not a lot of room for sidekicks in that world anymore. And, but there's also too, there's not a lot of Conan O'Briens who are willing to like, invite someone into that process. You know, I mean,
and it's also like I feel like our media literacy slash the buffet of options, like I don't know how much. I'm always curious, especially with like podcasts and stuff, like I'm always fascinated that people still have an appetite for hearing some other people talk, like learning about a celebrity or learning about, you know, whatever. I just sort of feel like the amount of stuff that I'm being bombarded with to like react to and enjoy and investigate and stuff.
Right.
It gets, but again, that's like old man Husky, chatting to old man Richter.
That's right. On the porch.
But it's like my daughter will get so mad at me when I'm not like, she'll start a show and usually I like, we'll watch it with her to kind of like make sure it's,
yeah.
I mean, she's actually watching Euphoria and I watched some of that with her. I'm like, okay, well, I will go back in time and acknowledge the things that I was watching at your age and I have to accept it.
Yeah.
You are. Yeah.
Oh no, I don't even worry. I'm like, you know, ugh.
Yeah.
Go watch whatever you want. You know, I mean, you're going to, they're going to be the people they are. It's not like,
totally.
Cause they watch kids, you know, edging each other that they're going to be like, I got to go to school and try and make someone come, you know?
Yeah, it's completely.
Like, it's like, they know.
I got to try
they're
heroin.
Smart. Yeah. Oh, to snort or shoot it. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. Let's look online. But yeah, she'll be like, why aren't you watching it? I'm just like, I have brain / emotional capacity for like two shows and everything else. It's just like,
well, Euphoria too. Like I knew my daughter loved it and I am, you know, and I do like one of the shows that I really loved over the years was Degrassi. Like I really like teen shows can be very, cause they're simple and they, you know, they're stripped away of a lot of nonsense and it's just kind of repeatable kind of dramas and traumas that teenagers go through. And so when Euphoria came around, I was like, oh, I'll check that out. And I think I watched one episode and I felt like such like a leering old man peeking through the bushes while beautiful children played. Like I was like, yeah. I don't, it does not make me feel good to watch this show.
I know. Yeah. We watched like 2-3 episodes or something, and I'd be like, they'll have like a little disclaimer, and I'm like, oop, well, get ready to feel real uncomfortable around your dad because this one's got drugs, sex, nudity. Yeah. You know, but I told her, I was like, the hardest thing for me watching these is just like, it just makes me sad because it's just like, I mean, it's hard enough to see like children go through this stuff, but and I've known so many people doing this stuff. It just, But I mean, but the other, then unpacking it with her, it's good because, you know, she's like, what does it feel like to have the, you know, DTs? And I'm like, well, it feels like your bones are made of glass, apparently, and your skin itches like it's on fire. She's like, oh my God, why would anybody, you know, and the right response is like, why would anybody want to do drugs if that's the response?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Well, the answer, I mean, because they're fun.
Like, oh, it feels so good.
Oh my God, they're so fun.
It replaces every second of suffering you've ever had. I'm not saying it's worth it.
No.
But it's worth it.
Very popular for a reason.
Very popular. We're almost done, but I did want... you're one of the... divorce. Mm-hmm. You're divorced. I'm sorry, but I also hope that it's the right thing.
It's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, that's good.
It was... you know, of course it was awful, but everybody's okay. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, just hearing you say that it was awful, like... I think I understand, and hearing you say like the weight you lost and the hair you lost and stuff, nobody really tells you that it's a death. It's like it's sort of like having your village burned to the ground.
Yes.
Like it's so many unexpected
the
upheaval of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. The things that hit you afterwards, things that you didn't expect at all. And like you said, you know, to me, one of the big things was it was a death of a future that I had just come to rely on in my head. Yeah, and I didn't know the exact particulars, but it was within some pretty narrow parameters of what the rest of my entire life was going to be like. Because we were together for 27 years, married for 25.
Wow.
And so... you know, for years, there was just, this is my life. And this is kind of like, you know, and job things will change and maybe we'll move somewhere else. But it was my life. And it was the picture that I held of my life for literally decades. And it was dead. I killed it, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing that really gutted me and it's still not, I mean, it still bothers me. Like, I don't live with my kids. Like, my daughter comes over here and stays with me and stuff, but, like, I don't live with my kids, you know? And, and my son's 21, so he's out of the house and stuff. And I live 10 minutes away, so it's like I'm still very close. And my daughter does kind of treat it, she, you know, calls it like two houses, but, you know, like she has two houses.
Yeah.
But it just, I didn't inhabit the same house as my kids anymore. Was like... you know, because the things are, you make this drastic change because you don't see any other way to make things better.
Right.
And then there's just all the shit that like, oh yeah, right. I'm not going to live with my children anymore.
Right.
And how much that hurts and how much you have to get used to that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, right after my sister got divorced years ago, and I remember talking to her shortly after we split, and she's like, it'll take a few years, like a couple of 3 years before you really, and I was like, what?
Yeah.
I mean I only have like a month before I want to get back to feeling like a normal guy, you know.
I was given like the half-life rule. It was sort of like, it's like half the amount of time you were together is how long it'll take you to get back to being normal. And I was with we were married for six. I was like, it's going to take me 6 years to get back to, and it kind of is true. Like, it took me a while.
Yeah.
And I dated during that time.
Yeah.
I did all the, you know, I met my girlfriend on Bumble finally, but it was definitely at a point towards the end where I was like, well, all right, let's just see who else is crazy in the world. But actually, I say that like, but it wasn't that my online dating thing was not as insane as I thought it would be.
No.
Like I met some really cool people.
I did too. I found it to be like there's a beauty to it in terms of just like the practicality of people getting into a space and going like, you know what? I'm lonely.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, yeah, you know what? I am too. And I would like to, you know, meet someone and possibly fall in love with them. You know what? I would too. And, and it's a very tender thing to do. It's a very revealing thing to admit to and to show publicly. And, you know, and people's, you know, there's varying levels of sincerity and openness and emotion in people's, their profiles and stuff. And some of them are absurd and entirely mockable, but everyone on there is admitting, I need somebody, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was kind of like, ugh, about getting into it. And I'm like, no, it makes great. Like, this is so efficient.
Yeah.
This is so efficient. And, you know, and then you got texting. And so it's like, you already get to talk before you go and have the coffee or whatever.
And that was like on Raya. That was the thing where I was like, man, if a lot of these people are not getting past the funny test in the texting exchanges. I was just like, all right, well, you're beautiful. But,
right. Yep.
But I'm already bored, so I can't even start that.
Yeah.
Andrew, this has been a delight.
Thank you. It's good to see you. We should get together. Definitely.
I love that. You have the Three Questions podcast.
I do.
Which you reluctantly are doing, but it's...
no, I like doing it. And I mean, I've learned how to interview people, you know, by doing it. And listening to them as much as I can handle listening to myself and correcting things. Like I had John Flansburgh, they might be Giants on. And he said to me, he's like, I have to ask you something. And I'm like, oh, okay, what? And he said, did you condition yourself to not say like? I said, yes, I did. Because I would listen and I would say like too much. And so I made a conscious, like, I got to stop saying like.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. I, in listening to this early on, I definitely had that, and I had I can't remember my stammer point was. Like, I'm pausing as my brain reloads.
Yeah.
But now I'm going to be really aware of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, for me, it was like, and then while people were talking, going, like, shut up and just let them talk. You know, we know you're still there, you know, take it easy.
The Daily with Michael Barbaro.
I've heard of it. Yeah.
So he has a very distinctive voice but he does that because they just do interview things where it'll just basically somebody's giving you a big old chunk of information.
Mm-hmm.
And for him to acknowledge that he's there, it'll just be this occasion like, and it's not natural, and it doesn't sound like someone going, ah, I see.
Yes,
it's
just right. like someone trying to balance, you know, crystals on each other, like crystal glassware on top of each other.
He's holding a hot bagel while he's doing this like interview. Cool. Well, thanks for coming by, Andrew, and I'm glad you have hair, but listen, it's pretty cool over here.
Thank you.
Give it a shot sometime. All right, everybody, stay bald. Bye.
Bye.
Talking bald, yeah. Life is unfair when you lose all your hair, but now you've got someone to talk to. Brian and Charlie have a hairless party, and they are all there to invite you. No hairdos, no shampoos, interviews, only on Bald Talk.
Ever wanted to hear from the neighbor at 9 Cloverfield Lane? Or what if I told you that Dr. Loomis's worst patient wasn't Michael Myers? I'm Adam Peacock, host of the podcast My Neighbors Are Dead. Join me each week as I talk to the lesser-known characters from your favorite horror films. Each week is an all-new, fully improvised journey into the unknown featuring friends and luminaries from the worlds of comedy, horror, and beyond.
New episodes every Tuesday on Campfire Media. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
Campfire.